This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Evolution of the World and of Humanity. This is Lecture 3. A very reasonable objection to the study of anthroposophy is that investigation into the facts of the spiritual worlds depends upon the investigator having gone through a development such as I have described. For only thus can these facts be called forth from the more deeply underlying forces of man's nature, until we are ourselves able to approach them. It might be objected that those who have neither undergone such development, nor had personal experience of the supersensible facts and beings, could never prove the truth of the statement made by the investigator concerning them. When the spiritual world and its contents is openly discussed and statements are made about them, it is very frequently objected, quote, "Of what use are all these ideas about a supersensible world to one who is not yet able to see it?" Close quote. This objection is based on a complete misconception. It assumes that in speaking of a supersensible world we are talking of something of which nothing whatever is known, but this is not the case. There is, however, a very remarkable difference between the initiation science, which is right for the present day, and that which was adapted to those more ancient times of which I spoke in my last lecture. You will remember that I represented the way into the spiritual world as leading first to the vision of a mighty life tableau, in which was shown the experiences incorporated into the personality of the student during that earth life. He could at once see all the experiences of his present life. I then went on to say that when we rise from imaginative to inspirational cognition, we can eventually, through the emptied consciousness and the absolute inner stillness and quietude, succeed in visualizing our pre-earthly life, and we are thus led into the world of spiritual facts, through which we passed between our last death and our descent again to earth. Now, it must be borne in mind that each one of us has experience of that before descending to earth. There is not a single human being who has not had, in its full reality, this experience of which the spiritual investigator of the spiritual world relates. When he tells of these hitherto unknown facts and clothes these facts in words, he does not really appeal to something of which man is totally ignorant, but to what each one has experienced before his earth life. He simply appeals to our cosmic memories to reawaken them within us. What he relates dwells in each one of those here present today and rests in their souls. But in crossing the gulf between the pre-earthly and the earthly life, it has been forgotten. The investigator of spiritual worlds simply reminds people of what they have forgotten. Suppose you meet a man with whom you were formerly associated in your present earth life. You may have a clear recollection of what you experienced together some 20 years ago, which he may have completely forgotten. In the course of conversation, you can, by reminding him of what is distinctly present in your memory, bring back the recollections of it to his. It is that same process carried to a higher stage on which I rely when telling you of higher worlds. The only difference is that what was experienced in pre-earthly lives is more completely forgotten. Only because people feel a reluctance, a dislike, to ask themselves seriously, quote, "Do we not discover in our own souls something which is in agreement with what the investigator of the spiritual relates?" Close quote. On account of that feeling of reluctance, they do not probe deeply enough into their souls after listening to what he relates or when reading the books. They therefore believe that what he describes is known to him alone and cannot be proved. It can perfectly well be proved if people will free themselves from the prejudice which arises from this dislike. In short, the spiritual investigator does but appeal to what has been experienced by every human being in his pre-earthly life. Now, it might be objected, quote, why then should we, during earth life, be specially called upon to reflect upon that which, as arranged by the cosmos, we might even say by the decree of the gods, we have already experienced in our super-earthly existence, close quote. Again, there are people who say, quote, why should I bestir myself to attain this knowledge of the supersensible worlds before death? I can wait till I am dead, when I shall encounter all this, if indeed it really exists. Close quote. This idea rests upon a complete misconception of earthly life. The facts of which the spiritual investigator tells have indeed been experienced by everyone in his pre-earthly existence. But the thoughts he formed about them can only be experienced in earth life. And only such thoughts as we have worked at here on earth do we carry with us through the gates of death. They help us to understand the facts and experiences of life between death and rebirth. The life of a man between death and rebirth, during the present evolution of humanity, is extremely difficult, unless he has acquired thoughts of the supersensible world during his earth life. If he is not, he cannot, after passing through the gates of death, gain a true knowledge of his surroundings. He knows he is surrounded, but the understanding of what is about or around him must have been acquired in earth life. In the subsequent lectures it will be shown that this does not apply to the humanity of earlier ages. But at the present stage in the evolution of humanity, it must be more and more impressed on people that the understanding of what they will experience in the supersensible world between death and rebirth must be acquired here on earth. Thus it can be said that spiritual science is quite justified in speaking openly today, for everyone can test it if he will but probe deeply enough into his own soul. He would then gradually be forced to admit that what he has heard from the spiritual investigator illumines him. He must admit he feels as though he had already experienced this, and as if the thoughts now given him concern what he has already lived through. On this account it is so very necessary, in speaking on spiritual science and spiritual knowledge, to choose one's language more carefully than in ordinary life. For a person coming in touch with spiritual science must even, by the very way in which the subject is handled, receive the following impression, quote, what I learn here does not apply to the sense world. It would there be considered nonsense, close quote. Opponents then come along saying, quote, what you are being told as being based on spiritual cognition is all nonsense. It is fantastical, close quote. As long as people have or wish to have knowledge of the sense world alone, they are justified in saying this. But the supersensible world has a different aspect. A man who will give up his physical prejudices and probe more deeply into the nature of his own soul, will admit, quote, what the spiritual investigator says is simply a stimulus, inciting me to draw forth from my own soul what is already there, close quote. Of course, there is a great deal standing in the way of such an avowal. But as regards an understanding of the supersensible worlds, this self-admission is one of the most necessary points of all. And we shall see that even the most difficult things can be understood if one probes deeply into one's own self. Among those difficult things, we must certainly reckon the truths of mathematics. What is learned through mathematics is considered absolutely correct. Now, it is very strange that even mathematics and geometry are no longer correct when we enter the spiritual world. The point is as follows. I will make it clear by a very simple example. We have, from our youth up, been accustomed to consider the old Euclid truth as an axiom, as a matter of course, If there is a point A and another point B, the shortest distance between the two is the straight line. A curved line must be longer. A great part of our geometry, which is of course correct as regards the physical world, rests upon this knowledge. In the spiritual worlds, this is reversed. There, the straight line between A and B would be the longest distance. Any other would be shorter, because in the spiritual world, any other line can be freely followed. If one pictures oneself having to go from A to B, it is easier there to think of oneself as following any curved line, while to keep to a straight line, to keep in that direction at every point, is the slowest way of all. The slowest method in the spiritual world is to measure a straight line in two-dimensional or one-dimensional space. If a man considers the subject of attentiveness, and, as I now frequently advise, searches deeply into his own soul, which really signifies attentiveness, he will realize that what the spiritual investigator relates from his own experience must also hold good in this connection. He says to himself, quote, "When I roam about at will, I get through my journey easily." Close quote. This roaming around need not apply simply to actual measured distances, but to what one accomplishes daily. Most people are so busy from morning to night, they hardly notice that they are only doing what they are accustomed to do, what they did yesterday, and what is supposed to be the right thing to do. Just consider how much more slowly you would get through all you do if at each single point you were to pay great attention to what you are doing. Now, unless one pays attention in the spiritual world, there is nothing there at all. There is no such thing as custom there. The, quote, thing to do, close quote, is not known in the spiritual world. Quote, "We must now go to luncheon or supper," close quote. "It is the right thing to wear such and such clothes on such and such an occasion." All this, which plays so great a part in the civilized world, especially in our present civilization, does not exist in the spiritual world. There, each step, however small, and indeed even less than a step, must be followed with personal attentiveness. This is expressed by saying that in the spiritual world, the straight line between two points is the longest distance. Thus we have the antithesis. In the physical world, the straight line is the shortest distance between two points. But in the spiritual world, the straight line is the longest distance between them. If we do but probe deeply enough into the soul, we become attentive to the fact that a real understanding of these curious things can be found therein. And we are then more and more ready to admit that what the spiritual investigator reveals is in reality but a wisdom lying dormant in our souls. We only need to be reminded of it. The stages leading to the acquisition of supersensible cognition are given in title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and How to Attain It, and similar works, so that everyone today, in so far as his destiny, his karma, allows, can, as we shall see, tread this path and attain his own perception of the spiritual world, and thereby gain insight into the facts and understanding of ideas of the spiritual world. He can acquire this through the above-mentioned knowledge, individual knowledge of what is forgotten when earth life is entered upon. It may be said that the knowledge of the spiritual world, which can be communicated in the form of ideas, is comprehensible to everyone. What the spiritual investigator relates can be understood by all. The one thing necessary is that a man's reason should be unprejudiced and have probed deeply enough into the soul. To be able to investigate spiritual facts and enter the spiritual world, or to speak at first hand of the facts of that world, it is necessary, of course, necessary to have traveled along the path of self-knowledge. Anyone is justified in speaking quite openly of the spiritual worlds, if he has knowledge of them, through the communications of another. For he can today, even through the knowledge he acquired at school, gain the power of understanding and of discrimination. By means of these, he can advance to the comprehension of what is given out by spiritual science. Even in this respect, things were different for humanity of old from what they are today. Hence, the conduct of those who taught in the mysteries and practiced art and religion therein differed considerably from that of a spiritual investigator today. At the present time, one who speaks to those around him of spiritual cognitions must be careful so to muster his ideas that they may call up recollections of pre-earthly life. He must, in a sense, so speak to his audience and write for his readers as to recall in them memories of their pre-earthly lives. We might say that every address on the subject of spiritual science actually appeals to the listener in the following way. Listen to what is being said. Search deeply into your own soul, and you will find it already there. You will begin to realize that you cannot have learned all this in your earth life, for neither the flowers, nor the clouds, nor the springs, nor even the science, based on reason and the senses, can ever have told you of it. You will come to realize that you yourself brought the knowledge with you into earth life, that before your earth existence you took part in things which have left behind in your soul, as though in a cosmic recollection, something which is awakened by spiritual science. The spiritual investigator certainly appeals to the profoundest depths of the human soul when he communicates these truths. We are not being asked to accept something foreign to us, but simply to recollect what is actually the deepest possession of the human soul itself. This was not the case in olden times. The wise ones of the mysteries, the priests, had then to act in a different way, for the men of old had of themselves a memory of their pre-earthly existence. A few thousand years ago, primitive man never doubted that in his soul there was something which he had brought down with him from a supersensible world into this life of sense, for he experienced it every day in dreamlike imaginations. In his soul there was something of which he said to himself, quote, "My eyes with which I see the trees have not given me this, nor my ears with which I hear the singing of the nightingales, nor have any of my other senses. It is all in my own soul. I could not have absorbed it during my earth existence. It was already within me when I descended into earth life. And when, during my embryonic state, another human body gave me a physical earthly body, that which now lights up within me in dreamlike imaginations was already there. I only clothed it in a physical human body." Close quote. It would in no wise have helped a man of olden times with his development if his attention had been drawn to the fact that he possessed a subconscious memory of a pre-earthly existence, though this is the very first thing of which modern man must be made aware, as also that this memory can be awakened into consciousness. In the older mysteries, man had to be made attentive to something quite different. In olden times, man felt, so to speak, a deep sorrow in connection with all the beautiful things in the sense world. He saw the flowers in their wondrous beauty springing forth from the ground and unfolding their blossom, and could also see the beneficent properties they possessed. He perceived the bubbling spring and all its beauty, a beauty which can become manifest if one approaches it from the shadow of a tree. And he was quite naturally aware through his senses of the refreshing qualities of such a spring. Then he said to himself, quote, "All this seems to have fallen through sin, away from that world which I bear within me, which I brought with me into physical existence when I descended from the spiritual worlds." Close quote. The teachers in the mysteries had the task of explaining that even in the flower, even in the bubbling spring, even in the rustling of the forest, in the song of the nightingale, and in all things, spiritual beings work and weave, and can everywhere be found. These teachers had to communicate the great truth, quote, "What lives within thee lives in outer nature too," close quote. For at that time, when man had the freshest and most receptive sense of the external world, when the intellect was least able to explain the laws of nature, when he contemplated the outer world with his primitive senses, he regarded that outer world with sorrow and pain. He saw the external world, he saw its beauty, its growing, budding beauty. It impressed itself on his eyes and ears and other senses. But he could not help feeling pain and sorrow in all this. This beauty was the very thing that caused him the most sorrow, because he was unable to unite it with what lived in his soul as the content of his prenatal existence. The wise men of the mysteries, therefore, had the task of pointing out that the divine spiritual lived in all things, even in the things pertaining to the world of sense. They had to show men the spirituality in nature. This they could only do by following a different course from that necessary for us today. Just as it is now, above all, necessary to show people how to remember their prenatal life, so was it then necessary for those old teachers in the mysteries to call forth in those assembled around them quite different recollections. Man, during his earthly existence, lives his life rhythmically in two, or rather in three, conditions: waking, dreaming, and sleeping. Sleep goes on unconsciously. This unconscious sleep, although differing somewhat from ours today, was also experienced by those men of old. They fell asleep, and they too passed into a condition in which none of the experiences of the soul rose into their consciousness. But man is also a living being while he is asleep. We do not die when we go to sleep, nor are we reborn when we awake. For we continue our life as soul and spirit between falling asleep and awaking. This will be gone into in more detail in the subsequent lectures. As far as the ordinary, everyday consciousness is concerned, our personal experience is totally extinguished from the time we fall asleep till we awake. In his ordinary consciousness, a man recollects what he experienced when he was awake, and he may perhaps recollect what he dreams, but not what he experiences during his dreamless sleep. He remembers nothing of that. The old mystery teachers trained their pupils in such a way that what they experienced in sleep, especially as regards the history of those times, was recalled to their memory. Through the ideas they put into the world, they also influenced the humanity in their vicinity and all those who drew near to them. The modern science of initiation has the task of reminding us of what lived in the souls of men before their earth lives, while the initiation of olden times had that of reminding man of his daily experience in sleep. All the knowledge which the old mystery teachers clothed in the form of ideas was therefore so ordained that the pupils or those who listened had to say, quote, "They tell us nothing but what we experience every time we sleep. We drive it down into our subconsciousness, but we go through it all in our sleeping state. It is no new thing of which the priests of the mysteries tell, but they, through their initiation, are able to see and to appreciate what the ordinary consciousness does not see during sleep, although it experiences it." Close quote. The old science of initiation recalled to man's memory something he had experienced, just as the modern initiation science recalls memories of pre-earthly life. The great difference between ancient and modern initiation is that in the former, man was reminded of what he generally slept through and which in his day consciousness he could not recollect. The wise ones of the ancient mysteries brought the night experiences into the consciousness of day and taught men as follows, quote, "At night thou livest with thy soul in the spiritual world, that world which also dwells in every spring, in every nightingale, in every flower. Every night thou enterest into that which, during the day, thou canst only perceive with thy senses. Close quote. Man could thus be convinced that the gods of whom he was aware in his waking, dreaming state also lived in nature outside. Thus, by revealing to him the content of his sleep, the wise ones of the mysteries showed their pupils that there are divine spiritual beings in existing nature. Just as the modern spiritual investigator has the mission of showing man that before he descended to earth, he lived in the spiritual world as a spiritual being among spiritual beings, and that through certain concepts and ideas, he can recreate in his memory what he experienced in the pre-earthly existence. In the initiation science of today, when we rise from imagination to inspiration, we learn to know the true facts that divide sleep from the waking state. What a man really is as soul and spirit, from falling asleep till he awakens, can only be revealed to him by true inspirational cognition. But he can perceive his life tableau by attaining imaginative cognition. Only when, in his waking state, he forms the life tableau in his emptied consciousness, in the cosmic stillness, in the way I described, does his pre-earthly life enter his soul as inspiration from the cosmos. Then, in this inspiration, his own being appears before him in soul and spirit, as it is between sleeping and waking. What we are unconscious of in sleep, we become conscious of in inspiration. We learn to contemplate what we, as soul and spirit, do in our sleeping state. And we realize that on going to sleep, the spirit and soul principles go forth from the physical and etheric bodies. We leave the physical body and the etheric body, or body of formative forces, behind in bed. And this is seen in the imagination, just as I described it. The higher principles of human nature, which can, as I have said, be called the astral body and the actual organism of the ego, these leave the physical and etheric bodies and return to them when we awake. That division of our being, which takes place in every rhythmic transition from waking to sleeping, can only be seen in its actuality by means of inspiration. It can then be seen how all that we acquire in ordinary waking life, through our thinking, through our world of thought, really remains behind in bed. The thoughts we acquired with so much trouble in our school days, the cleverness we acquired for the use of our earthly intelligence, all this has to be left behind with the physical and etheric bodies when we go to sleep. Of these we only take with us, as ego and astral body into the spiritual world in which we sleep, that which differs absolutely from what we experienced in our waking state. When we have passed from waking to sleeping, we experience something which in our ordinary consciousness we cannot recall. That is why, in speaking of these things, I am obliged to do so in such a way that the ideas represent concepts in which the descriptions of man's unconscious experiences can be clothed, and which he can reflect upon with his healthy human reason, as mentioned in the early part of this lecture. In the first lecture of this course, I described how, on going to sleep, we leave behind us our usual method of thinking of the things of the world in mere shadow pictures of true living thought, and accustom ourselves to a world in which we do not really think in the way we do here in the earthly world, but where we experience things as they are, experience them inwardly. During sleep, man actually experiences the light, though unconsciously. He experiences the action of the light and learns how the light, in contrast to objects, causes these to appear in color and shade. In our waking life, we think about these things. We form thoughts about light and its action. These thoughts we leave behind us, while we ourselves enter the weaving, living light. We pour ourselves forth into the weaving, living light. Just as we, here as earth men, carry our physical body about with us during the day, and wandering about on the earth's surface move through the air with our soul and our spirit, so as sleeping men, we enter the moving, surging light, and ourselves become beings, consisting of moving, living light. We become light within the light. When a man is inspired by what he himself becomes every night, when that arises in his waking consciousness, only then does he become aware, quote, "When thou sleepest, thou thyself livest as a cloud of light in the cosmic light," close quote. This does not, however, imply merely living in the light as light substance. It means living in the forces, which in the waking life become thoughts and can be grasped by means of thought. The light we thus experience is everywhere permeated by forces, forces which are inwardly active in the plants and animals, but also have an independent existence as spiritual beings. Light is not there experienced as it is here in the physical world. The weaving, living light is really, if I may use so inaccurate an expression, is really a body of spiritual activity, and also of separate spiritual beings. Here in the physical world, we as human beings are enclosed within our skin. There, during the sleep condition, we are light within the light, and other beings are light within the light. We cease to perceive light as light, as we are accustomed to do here in the physical world. But if I may now express myself pictorially, the clouds of light, which are ourselves, can objectively perceive other beings composed of clouds of light. These objective light cloud beings, however, are either another human being, or a being inhabiting a plant, or perhaps a being that never incarnates in a physical body, but always remains in the spiritual world. Thus light is not there experienced as light, like our earthly light, but as living, active spirituality. Now you know that as physical human beings on earth, we also live in another element. We live in warmth, perceived physically. A man knows when he is warm and when he is cold. He heats his room in cold weather. Thus he knows in a physical sense, as far as his ordinary consciousness is concerned, that he lives either in the warmth or in the cold. What he feels as warmth or cold, he experiences in feeling. He has the feeling of warmth or cold. Now when we abandon our physical and etheric bodies on going to sleep, we ourselves live as warmth substance in the warmth substance of the cosmos, just as we live as light within the light. Thus we are not merely clouds of light, so to speak, but clouds of light surged through and interwoven with warmth. And everything we perceive has also warmth within it. But just as we, as souls and spirits in this spiritual existence, during our sleeping condition, do not experience the light merely as light, but as living spiritual beings, and when we acquire the inspirational consciousness, recognize ourselves as living spiritual beings, and other beings too as living spiritual beings, so too is this the case with respect to warmth. We could not get along in the spiritual world, or gain much good from inspiration, if we were only furnished with the concepts acquired here in the physical world. Just as we must acquire a different concept of the shortest distance between two given points, so must we also fill our souls with a different content concerning other things. Just as we experience ourselves as light within light, and realize ourselves as spirits in the spirit land, so too, when we experience ourselves as warmth beings within the cosmic warmth, we know that this is not the warmth to which we are accustomed in the sense world, we realize that we are in a world of weaving, invigorating love. As the beings of love, which we are in the supersensible world, we realize that we are among beings of such a nature that they cannot do otherwise than draw the whole essence of their being from love. Their lives of love cannot but be one with the universal cosmic life of love. Thus, between going to sleep and awakening, we experience ourselves as living a life of love, wholly filled with spirit. Therefore, if we ourselves wish to enter that world in which we daily pass the time between sleeping and waking, we must, as I said in the last lecture, increase our capacity for love. For that world will otherwise be completely foreign to us. Spiritualized love does not hold sway in this world of ours here below. We are governed by the driving force of a love influenced by material existence. But in the spiritual world, the spiritualized love just described is the guiding principle. If, therefore, we wish to enter with our full consciousness the world in which we live every night, we can do so by first developing our capacity for love in the manner described yesterday. We cannot really come to ourselves without it. For what actually takes place in sleep during a third part of our life on earth must forever remain a closed book to us, unless we can investigate it by developing and enhancing our power of love. What a man experiences during his hours of sleep must ever be a dark enigma to the inhabitants of earth, unless they are able, by the power of love, to surge so far ahead as to become, in a sense, aware of what they experience in their other condition between sleeping and waking. But we leave behind us in bed the form of activity which we developed in our thinking while carrying our physical and etheric bodies about with us. And while we are asleep, that activity joins in the unitary movement of the whole cosmos. If man were really able to be completely conscious of what goes on in his physical and etheric bodies at night, he would perceive his etheric body hard at work thinking all night long. He would contemplate this from without, while he himself lived as a warmth-giving being of light. We can go on thinking when we with our souls are no longer there, for that which we leave behind us in bed sends the thought vibrations further and further afield. It continues to think. It thinks on. And when we wake up in the morning, we plunge down into that which remained lying in bed and which has gone on thinking. We meet our own thoughts again in the morning. They have not died in the meanwhile. Tomorrow I have to speak of how, when we are not present, we may be much cleverer, much more intelligent than we are in our day consciousness when present in soul. What is thought during the night when a man is absent is often much cleverer than what he thinks in his waking hours when he is there in soul. At any rate, I just wished to indicate today that thinking is carried on in the etheric and physical bodies, and that, when we wake in the morning and vaguely remember a dream, that dream signifies that, in a sense, the soul is dammed up when it awakens and re-enters the etheric and physical bodies. Here is the physical body, here the etheric body or the body of formative forces, and there the astral organization and the organization of the ego, which in the morning plunge into the physical body and etheric body. In so doing, however, a sort of denser wave, a denser ripple, makes its way into what is clearer, and a damming up ensues. This is then experienced as a morning dream, the ego and astral body having woven all night in the light and warmth. Now plunge into the thoughts, but do not immediately understand them, and this stoppage is experienced as a morning dream. Tomorrow we shall consider the dream itself, and its enigmatical position in the whole life of man, and the further relation between sleep and the waking life of man. The end. of Lecture 3.